The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, David, we've talked about certainty over the last few weeks, and the markets themselves, the stock market, the interest rate markets, they seem to have built in certainty. Yet there are fingers of instability everywhere. You know, we're hearing horror stories coming out of Africa with the Ebola outbreak. And then, you know, we're also hearing Africa in the news right now. Obama is coming out and saying, you know, Africa, that's America's new direction, where we're going to help them from a business standpoint over the next 10 years.
Well, and what's interesting to me is that the African Congress, which is going on this week with, you know, heads of state from 50 countries attending, you know, state functions in Washington, we've missed the boat for a decade. And it's been Europe and it's been China who've locked up the continent. They've been chasing natural resources. And certainly the Chinese have turned a blind eye to the issues of human rights violations throughout Africa by existing leadership. So there's been a trade deal set probably every week. I mean, if you go to any African country, you will see Chinese everywhere. But the Europeans are sort of quick on their heels. I can't believe we're kind of coming at this and saying this is the next future and greatest deal, because frankly, our biggest trade deal was oil. We were importing a massive amount, and I say we're, past tense, we're importing a tremendous amount of oil from Nigeria, from Algeria, and as we have increased our production here in the United States, the shale revolution has caused about an 85% drop in our African oil imports. This went from being a $100 billion a year commitment to Africa to now about a $15 billion a year commitment in terms of oil trade. So we're at a 40-year low there, and I just don't know what Obama can offer other than, you know, promises not to develop U.S. energy resources, because that certainly would sort of roll the clock back. The last 5 years of our moving towards energy independence has really cut the Africans out, and it's because they have the same quality of oil that we have, the light, sweet crude.
Well, and it seems like it may be just window dressing. You know, we're hosting the meeting, so we've got to say something nice. Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the space program. Okay, you know, the various presidents here recently have talked about going to the moon or going to Mars or going to an asteroid, but really, the reality of the situation is nobody's got the inclination, the money, or the interest anymore to do anything in space. And, you know, a big part of that is we've got $17 trillion in debt, Dave. We can't do much with that kind of debt. I mean, look at Argentina, okay? They have figured it out.
But on the other hand, just because we have lots of debt doesn't mean we can't print more money out of nothing. So, well, I mean, again, promises are one thing. Being able to deliver on them is another. And I think, frankly, what we've done or undone in terms of our oil relationship with Algeria and Nigeria, we've dropped our imports from Algeria by 75% in the last year. This is the kind of thing that reshapes political alliances and creates continental priorities which cannot compare with any sort of aid packages which we might put together in the interim.
Well, and you talked about human rights. I mean, obviously, we have to turn a blind eye to human rights if we're going to get involved with Africa, because it's horrible there. But, you know, I remember Khrushchev. He said that one of the goals that Russia would take is Africa, because it was a natural resources depository. He didn't care what happened to the politics in Africa. He just wanted the gold. He wanted the diamonds. He wanted the platinum. And, you know, you look at China, you look at the Asian countries right now that are forming these alliances. There really are a lot of resources in Africa. And frankly, you know, if they do ally away from America, platinum, look at platinum. I mean, it almost all comes from either Russia or South Africa.
And you mentioned Argentina. I mean, Argentina, the debt issues both here and there are a big deal. Perhaps this is a little bit less of a crisis scenario. As of last week, they defaulted on $30 billion in debt, which is a fraction of what they defaulted on in 2001.
But don't cry for me, Argentina, because they've done this before, right?
Eight times in the last 200 odd years. And, you know, so it is a little repetitive. It's like the scratch in the record. It's just a question of how long it takes to circle around. Is it about 10 years now? Should we default again? Should we destroy our currency yet again? And this time it's actually for legal reasons and not financial reasons. So you've got a lot of folks who are sort of betting on a sharp rebound. And, you know, I don't know, pro-business replacement for the Kirchner clan, I don't know if we'll see that or not. will we explore opportunities in Argentina? Well, you know, you and I are taking an exploratory trip down in October in anticipation of political change. And there is the possibility. There's a possibility that just like in the 1982 Falklands conflict, that preceded the collapse of the regime and was used as an excuse. You know, there is this conflict and everyone should not look at the economic chaos that's going on. We have this conflict right off of our coast. And of course, it was about a year after that, that the dictatorship collapsed. So, you know, we have the current default cycle. Maybe it negatively impacts the Kirchner legacy. But, you know, it's so hard. It's so hard to judge politics in Latin America because they can just as easily rally around nationalist feelings, pointing to sort of the foreign devils in pinstripe suits who are coming down as what they call vulture capitalists to buy debt and redeem it at full value.
Well, and, you know, Argentina is an interesting petri dish for any country that goes through a debt situation where they have to either default or devalue their currency. One way or another, debt gets paid. It's either the person who owns the debt, they lose everything, or the person who owns the currency, they end up losing everything in the devaluation of the currency.
Yeah, and it's not as if this is uncommon. Eight times in the last 200 years, six of which have happened since 1950 in Argentina. Peru is no different. You've had five defaults just like this since 1950. Dominican Republic, probably less, maybe two since 1975, but it's not as if this is just the Latin world. We've got Turkey, who's had eight defaults, Greece, who's had seven, Austria, in the same time frame, going back to 1800, seven defaults. Spain, again, six. Russia, five. It's not just Latin America. As you look around the world, it's actually a fairly universal constant. Again, that idea of a scratched record, it's just a matter of time. When you're dealing with high levels of debt and fiat currency together, you know what you end up with? A pretty predictable recipe. You get in over your head, and then you print like mad. And then ultimately, you either default explicitly or implicitly. It just depends on what the political or geopolitical ramifications will
be. Well, and David, you know, patterns can be recognized if you can have enough time to actually see the patterns. And, you know, we live very short lifetimes. I mean, it's just a flash. But if we had lived, say, 500 years, we'd realize that default is actually the norm. I mean, default, you take out debt and then you default. You take out debt, you print money, you default. So with that being the case, then the person who owns bonds, I don't care what country, even the United States, probably needs to take note at this point and say, you know, what kind of default am I facing? Anytime you buy debt, what kind of default am I actually buying into?
You know, it's funny. When you look back at sort of the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, your better bets were sort of corporate loans. Your worst bets were the sovereign loans because you were basically pressured. When a king needed to borrow money or a queen needed to borrow money, there really was no option. You had to loan the money because they could really do damage to you. They could throw you in jail. They could make you disappear, and there really was no legal recourse. So you loan the money to the monarchy. You loan the money to the throne, but you knew you were going to take a hit. And fairly predictably, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, sovereign debt, it was always defaulted on. And that's, it's funny because in the history of borrowing, it's considered now that sovereign debt is the best place to loan money. You're not going to lose money there, but you could lose money to a commercial enterprise. And quite the opposite in the history of borrowing. It's only in the last 50 to 60 years where that's become a different scenario. And we only think about sovereign defaults in the context of, say, Latin America.
Well, David, you know, default doesn't necessarily have to be during a time of geopolitical stress. You know, we have had a period of relative peace since World War II. Let's face it. Worldwide, I mean, we had World War I, which was continued into World War II. World War I, we pointed out last week or a couple of weeks ago, you know, we reached the 100-year anniversary of the beginning of that war. But now what you have is you have a lot of different alliances going a lot of different directions. Okay, let's say that you did have debt or currency of countries back in 1914, 100 years ago. Well, all bets were off in 1914. Even the gold standard bet was off at that time. But I'm thinking about alliances that we're looking at right now. Okay, I was watching NASA TV last night. Granted, I'm a geek. But the Russians now are somewhat separated from the Americans. They're both occupying the same station. But this alliance, this wonderful worldwide, you know, let's hold hands and call it peace, build a station together, now looks like we're going to war with each other. But alliances are strange. They can shift, can't they? I mean, let's look at it. We are a predominantly Christian country. We are fighting predominantly Muslim countries at this point. Yet I think of this situation that's going on right now with Armenia and Azerbaijan. It reminds me of 100 years ago.
Well, it is very interesting because 100 years ago, you had the alliances which behind the scenes quickly embroiled the whole world in a conflict. And it seemed that a small skirmish here or there could have been easily contained or ignored. And now it snowballed. It snowballed because of alliances behind the scenes. And those alliances exist today. We in the U.S. are definitely connected to Azerbaijan.
Which is Muslim.
Exactly, which is ironic. It's about 90% Muslim, predominantly Shia. And then you've got Armenia, which is a Christian country, largely Christian country. And they are in cahoots with Russia, allied with Russia. And Armenia, I mean, the interesting thing, we lived in the second, my wife and I lived in the largest Armenian community outside of Armenia, which is in Glendale, California, for a number of years. This goes back 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, what is happening? What is happening? You've got 18 people who were killed in fighting in the last few days between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And the conflict most recently dates back to the early 90s. There was a peace negotiated in 1994, and that appears to be breaking down. It was over a contested territory, which Armenia had taken from Azerbaijan. Now, you know, again, you look at this part of the world, and you can look at the Syrian Empire. You can look at Alexander the Great. You can look at the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, literally over a 2,000-year period, whose land was it? It depends on which time slice you're talking about, because it's been contested and held by various empires. And now you've got, you know, people who believe that they have a right to this land. And they know it, they know it, they know, because their great-grandfathers and their great-grandfathers before them told them the stories of why that land was theirs. And this is really what you end up with. Our interests are allied with Turkey and Azerbaijan. Why? Well, listen. We've got two pipelines through Azerbaijan, which delivers Caspian Sea oil to Turkey and to Europe, and it circumvents Russia. It circumvents Russia. So these pipelines are very critical to us, and we're only too happy to be on friendly terms with a 90% Muslim, predominantly Shia population, and be in opposition to the Armenian Christian population and the country which is actually supported by Russia.
So I hate to say this, but, you know, when we look back at wars that were fought for, let's say, an ideal, that might not necessarily always be the case. Now, I know Common Core is trying to teach a very different type of history at this point, but I think we have to be realistic with the history that we've already experienced and that we're experiencing at this point, Dave. It's not necessarily human rights or human interests. We talked about Africa. We're talking now about Armenia. You know, those lines are drawn for different reasons. In Economist magazine this week, it talks about how the lines were redrawn after the last couple of wars. And you see these countries change. You know, after World War II, the lines, the national boundaries were changed, just like World War I. The guys who draw those lines are treaty makers, and we know that the seeds of the next war are in the last treaty.
Well, that's also been said that truth is the first casualty of war. So why we're in any conflict is always a question that will be asked in future generations, and I think getting to the truth of the matter is always a very, very challenging thing. But what is ever advertised by the mainstream media or the current political powers, you can assume that 95 to 98% of it is unmitigated balderdash. In the Nagorno-Karabakh region, this is that region which is in dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan. This is a region which is 30 miles from the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. And yes, this is one of the two Russian bypass lines. And this one in particular is capable of 1.2 million barrels per day, taking oil, again, from the Caspian Sea through Azerbaijan to Turkey. And, you know, in case you're wondering, who is the big corporate interest here? In the Western corporate interest, that is, it's BP. British Petroleum is the big Western company with a stake in that pipeline. And so, again, you wonder how backroom deals are sealed. You wonder why alliances exist. And, you know, ultimately, oil is a major issue. We've been talking about that in relation to Ukraine. We've been talking about that in relation to, you know, Joe Biden's son being involved in the oil company, or the gas company, rather, in Ukraine. These are issues which are very concerning. And ultimately, should we find another European conflict? I mean, keep in mind, from 3,600 BC forward, we've gone into a war, some sort of regional or even national, and in some instances, global conflict every 5 months. So it's not as if the history of the world is one of peace. It is actually a history of warfare. And then the question is just how you divide up personal interests and national interests. And again, however you advertise things, that's a question for the PR people. But what is done in terms of statecraft to benefit individual country interests? This is where the rubber meets the road. You can be critical of U.S. policy of, you know, displacing the Native American Indians, and you can always find a reason for policies that were put in place, and the truth is always very different than what was advertised. And I think, quite frankly, the easiest way to cut through the subterfuge is to ask one simple question. Where's the money? And this is where we see, again, a minor conflict perhaps today, not to minimize 18 soldiers dying on both sides, but a minor conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan has the potential of bringing the U.S. and Russia into extreme conflict. Why? Well, because, again, these are the bypass routes for Russian oil into Europe. And if we can in any way, as we discussed last week, begin to cut out, if we can change the energy balance of power and cut out the Russians, then we ultimately have greater sway in terms of European relationships and even our ability to export U.S. oil to that part of the world.
Well, and you know, we were talking about fingers of instability. Just as you're talking, I'm thinking, what an incredibly complex world to try to manage, which is exactly what we seem to be moving more towards, a UN type of style of management or a World Bank type of style of management. You know, we've talked to people with the Council on Foreign Relations. The goal is more of a centralized control, yet you have these regional complexities. You know, I think about how does an airliner shut down from Malaysia in Ukraine have to do with Russia? It has to do with Europe. It has to do with energy. It has to do with alliances in Israel. It has to do with Hezbollah. It has to do with Iran. Yeah, I'm just listening. Just as you're talking, I'm thinking, how in the world? Okay, and now we have Armenia, you know, Azerbaijan. All of these elements all have different links in these fingers of instability. And, you know, we haven't even started talking about the financial yet, Dave. You know, the bailout in Portugal, okay? You know, how do you manage this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Lisbon decides that, no, this bank cannot fail. And it's really an issue of uncertainty. What happens when debt liquidations can't be contained and they spread from one banking institution to the entire banking and financial system? So, yeah, Central Bank of Portugal is more than willing to spend $6.6 billion to bail out these liabilities. Now, of course, they wiped out the equity holders of the BES, that is Banco Espírito Santo. This is a bank that's been around for better than 100, almost 120 years. And yes, they were overextended. Yes, they were enmeshed in terms of their corporate structure. And ultimately, they failed.
Yeah, it's interesting, Dave. They were chosen too big to fail because they were the domino that could start many, many other failures. And it would. It would spread like a wildstorm, probably like a firestorm.
Well, and you've got Draghi, on the other hand, who's doing everything that he can to create bank stability and make sure that banks in Europe are buying government bonds. Why? Because the ECB mandate doesn't allow for direct financing of a particular government. So you can't have the same sort of fiscal and monetary enmeshment with the ECB that you have with the Bank of Japan, that you have with the Fed, because of constitutional rules, because of the bylaws, if you will, of the ECB when it was originally set up. So what is Draghi doing now? Well, in June, he began charging fees on excess reserves held at the ECB. He wants to take that money, which is being set aside as a sort of safe position outside the banking system, and he wants it back in the banking system because he still wants to stimulate growth. He sees very tepid, very slow growth in Europe, and he's trying to do everything he can, including by mandate, to get those euros back into the banking system and thus into the economy.
Do you think the free market is basically in a way saying, I'm too scared to grow. I'm just going to keep it at the ECB, even if they charge me a fee.
Well, the funny thing is he can try to do that, but you've got European banks, which keep also deposits with the Fed. And if you look at the equivalent number, if you will, what we call excess reserves of depository institutions, there's about $2.7 trillion of excess reserves of depository institutions sitting at the Fed. Now, very curiously, only about 1.3 of that is U.S. bank money. Over $1.07 trillion, nearly half of it, is European banks, that have branch operations in the United States, and they're willing to take their money and park it with the Fed. So, you know, the unintended consequence of Draghi charging fees on excess reserves held at the ECB is that money can just as easily flow into the United States and sit on the liability side of the Fed's balance sheet. So I think what we have is a Fed and an ECB and a Bank of Japan who are exploring every last option to try to stimulate growth in the economy, and it's getting more and more difficult to do so. Again, maybe it's that proverbial pushing on a string. You can do whatever you want, but the dynamics are such that you're not going to have the effect that you're hoping for.
Well, you see this control in the markets when you look at charts. We were just looking at a comparison chart of gold, the stock market, and the dollar just a few minutes ago, and you know, we were looking at the last 5 or 6 years. When the stock market really had its crash, gold came down a little bit and then it went way up. But then it got knocked down and has stabilized and gone sideways now at these new levels for the last year and a half or so. We've seen the same thing with the value of the dollar. We're seeing the same thing with interest rates. You can see the hand of control there. Now, here's what's interesting. When you look at the stock market, the only market actually rising in those charts, the dollar, you know, the stock market, and gold, the only chart that actually shows continued rise is the stock market. Yet we're seeing volumes drop. A lot of people are not in the stock market, but the few that are there, they're taking out massive margin debt because, you know, let's face it, are they chasing income? Are they trying to speculate to bring income in, you know, some of the fixed income people? You've been watching margin debt. What's been going on recently with the margin debt on buying stocks?
Well, this was an extended discussion point in our wealth management conference here in Durango, where we had a number of our wealth management clients fly in for a couple days briefing. And what we talked about at the time was that your major moves higher in margin debt were an indication of sort of the last gasp of speculation in the stock market.
It's always a sign of a crash coming.
Sure. 2000, yeah. The spike in margin debt preceded the decline in 2001. The spike in margin debt in 2007 preceded the decline in 2008 in equities. And 2014 is going to reach the history books and be one of those same periods. I think 2014 is an up year for the equity market. And it's either 2015 or 2016 where we see an absolute catastrophe in the U.S. stock markets. Well, you know, June's numbers were in. We got those at the end of last week, and the June numbers were released. It jumped $25 billion in a single month.
So the margin debt is up $25 billion in 1 month.
That's right. And it's $1 billion off the all-time record number in nominal terms. And then if you wanted to say, well, nominal terms, you know, things change with inflation. You've got to have some sort of a way of, you know, calculating it. It doesn't just look at nominal values. Well, as a percentage of stock market capitalization, it is at its highest level ever. And that would beat 1929. And that would even beat the 1999 to 2000 period. As a percentage of stock market capitalization, the speculative money, that is money borrowed from the bank to speculate in stocks, is at an all-time record high.
Could this be a reason why Warren Buffett has moved $55 billion to cash? I mean, I'm not trying to think like Warren Buffett. I don't know that I can. But his cash position right now, I think, is as high as it's ever been.
That's interesting. In the last 9 days, most of your major equity indexes have reached all-time highs. And, you know, then they've sold off a little bit. They're not quite at the top. And guess what? Your Wall Street cheerleaders have stepped in to say, you know, buy the value. This is such a great opportunity. Look, you know, market's backing up. You need to put money into the market right now. And you mentioned Buffett, you know, the master of buying value. He sees nothing to put $55.5 billion in cash into. Meanwhile, you've got the little guy coming into the market last week, $379 million, not a lot, but $379 million in retail investor funds coming into equities. And at the same time, institutions pulled $7.97 billion out of the stock market. So you've got institutions who are saying, time to mitigate some risk, time to tighten the belt, time to move things to cash. And the guy, John Q. Public, is still coming into the market saying, yeah, Bubble Vision just told me I need to be buying stocks right now. It, John Q., frankly, doesn't match up to the Oracle of Omaha in terms of sort of being a judge of value.
Well, I think it's worth repeating. $7.97 billion coming out, liquidations of institutions, and only $379 million for the small retail investor. That would be a guy like me going out and buying a stock. Okay, you're talking over 20-fold the sales versus the buys, institutions selling versus retail guys buying.
Yeah, so the market internals just aren't pretty. Breadth, leadership, momentum, small cap stocks are rolling over, junk bonds already have in the last couple of weeks, led on a decline. And then here in the last couple of days, you've got utilities. The utility index, the Dow Jones Utility Index, was the best average out there in terms of year-to-date performance. And guess what? They've sold off 8.5% in a matter of days.
Yeah, but talk about cheerleaders. Okay, we're now hearing that GDP growth, anytime they get a good number, they love to annualize it. Anytime they get a bad number, they explain it away and call it just bad weather. But since they got what they felt was a good number, they're saying that GDP growth annualized, if we keep this number up, is 4%. Why wouldn't that be good news?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. Nearly half of that number, the improvement to 4%, came from building up of inventories. So that's a reality. Plus, this is an estimate. We don't know until the end of August really what our import-export numbers are. And so the volatile factors that impact GDP growth, it's not settled yet. But by the way, building inventories is not selling product. And so there's a part of the GDP statistic which to me is a little bit irrelevant. It hurts you in the first quarter. It helps you in the second quarter. And it's inventory drawdowns, inventory buildups. And again, I'm more interested in actual activity. Consumers buying, maybe it is government spending, but something being done as opposed to just sort of filling the pipeline in hopes that there's going to be economic activity.
So buying inventory shouldn't necessarily be counted as growth until selling inventory actually occurs.
Yeah, running a business, I think I've got a pretty good beat on that. You're sitting on lots of inventory, it's very different. It's very different than actually closing a sale and eliminating or rolling that part of that inventory.
Well, let me just bring up, this is the fourth election year that we're going into since we started this show, okay? And it seems that each time we go into an election year, every 2 years, the numbers start getting better and better and better from about August, July, August on until we get to November, because the guys who control the numbers are the incumbents. They're the guys who want to get back in.
Well, it is interesting. There's a number of elements of Obamacare that are not being implemented until after the election. We're on schedule. On schedule to be implemented already, and they've been postponed till after November. Well, you know, I mean, you know, call it coincidence, call it what it is, political convenience. And I think what you find is that, yes, the numbers, whether it's GDP or the jobs numbers, they are tools that advertise success. And if you can do anything you can to manipulate those numbers, you will. Listen, last week's jobs number was anything but exceptional. And it would have been worse. It would have been worse had it not been for the inclusion of 80,000 jobs, which were fabricated. The birth-death modeling added 80,000 jobs. And even with that, we still moved up from 6.1 to 6.2, a tenth of 1% in the wrong direction. And of course, we missed expectations, which, again, they're going to do everything that they can to fix the numbers. Our suggestion is that you look behind the scenes and figure out what is actually happening in terms of economic activity.
Well, and you know, I know one index or several indexes that you like watching have to do with the movement of freight. You know, as strange as it sounds, that's a good way to see whether you've got a real recovery going on or if you're still, staggering a little bit. And, you know, what are the indexes, the movement of freight indexes doing at this point?
I think it's important to look at both indexes because on the one hand, Harpex looks at more of your dry bulk goods, and then your Baltic Dry Index actually captures a number of your tankers, whether it's your Suez Maxes and whatnot, where you may be hauling oil, you may be hauling a variety of goods, but the Baltic Dry and the Harpex, if you keep an eye on both of those, what they're really showing you is very tepid recovery. What are they? They're freight costs. What does it cost you to rent a boat? What is the day rate to rent one of these monstrous boats that you can put tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of either raw materials or finished product and deliver it to an end distribution point? These are freight costs, and they tend to increase with traffic. So if the economy is recovering, both in the United States and globally, you would expect to see freight costs increasing as there's an increase in traffic. And lo and behold, traffic has remained low, and prices to rent a boat, they're 75 to 80% below their peak levels. And if you said, well, okay, well, that's a little overdone because relative to a peak, let's talk about more relative to an average through a 20-year period. That's about 50% below a historic average. That, again, is just, it's sort of like looking at the Chinese GDP statistics and then asking, how much energy is being used. For instance, what are electricity or utility rates doing, and what is usage in China? And you often find a very different picture. Growth going off the charts, and yet a major contraction in energy consumption. And you have to ask the question, just how political is the GDP statistic in China? Frankly, anywhere in the world.
Well, okay, so let's say that you're Janet Yellen right now, and you have to make a public statement, so you're going to come out and say, well, we're watching GDP grow, we're watching employment coming back. We know those are probably false numbers. You know, she's not saying that, but down deep inside, she has to know those are probably false numbers, especially moving into an election. Yet she's still coming out and saying, we're going to use those numbers as our indicator as to whether we're going to cut back our quantitative easing. Now, Dave, for the last few years, we've been adding over $1 trillion a year just by buying our own debt with printed money. I mean, that's what quantitative easing is. How do you keep interest rates low and stop buying that debt? Is there somebody who can step in and do that? I mean, are we going to really ease quantitative easing going into an election?
It's an interesting proposition, and I'm still wrestling with the whole timing of QE. It's coming just before an election. I don't fully understand that. Is the assumption or understanding that something somewhere around the globe will be so ugly that safe haven demand for treasuries will keep rates low in the place of the Fed doing most of the buying? I don't know. But, you know, there is sort of this growing expectation in the marketplace for a shift in rates to a higher level. Let's say we even return to sort of 2006 to 2008, that time frame where the Fed funds rate was closer to 2% instead of sort of less than a quarter of a percent. You know, that would put the 10-year somewhere between 4 and 4.75%. Well, you know, there's consequences to that. You have a nasty effect on leveraged real estate, and that assumes that financing costs are still a significant factor in the pricing of that asset class. Campbell Real Estate Letter, great group and letter, particularly if you like California real estate, but he's out of San Diego, and he suggests that a 10, almost 11% increase in mortgage payments it should be expected for every 1% rise in mortgage rates. So, you know, the 10-year treasury moves higher, mortgage rates are moving higher. That's axiomatic. And your 1% rise in mortgage rates causes an increase in mortgage payments. What does that do to the person trying to sell their home? Most people who are on the buy side are looking at cash flow constraints. What can I afford? What does my income allow me to purchase in terms of a home? And so that increase in mortgage payments, because of the increase in mortgage rates, all of a sudden impacts negatively the price of real estate. Campbell would suggest that in that rising interest rate environment, even just normalizing rates back 150, 200 basis points higher, you're going to see a decline of 20% in terms of real estate values on that normalization theme.
Well, you know, we're wondering how you replace quantitative easing. And you know, we've talked about this, we've speculated on it, but, you know, we were trying to figure where would the money come from if it's not the Fed doing the buying. And for 3 weeks now, we've been talking about money market funds and the changes that the government's coming up with that may just answer that question.
Well, that's right. It's Bloomberg that's finally realized what's happening with the money market funds and the SEC ruling, which recently went into effect. You basically have $500 billion, which is expected to roll into treasuries. So who wins and who loses? This all of a sudden becomes very easy to figure out. It's like that moment in a Shakespeare play where you're realizing the plot is thickening. The treasury has a new source for buying, and that is the money market funds that want to maintain their status as $1 constant net asset value. Guess who loses, though?
The corporates.
Yeah, the corporate borrower gets the short end of the stick. And granted, these rules aren't fully implemented until 2016, but the market begins to adapt long before the rules are fully in effect. And I think, again, that's a very interesting time frame to keep in mind. About 2016, you've got a shift in emphasis. Money market funds are buying more treasuries. Corporate borrowers who have been adding to their total stock of debt aggressively are now in the awkward position of having to finance it at higher rates, and they don't have access to the commercial paper markets via the money market funds without some penalties attached. So these are the changing complexities, both within the worlds of finance and geopolitics. The way you described it, I think, is apt. Fingers of instability. We don't know exactly how this plays out, but it's going to require that the ball bounces exactly the right way, or we may have a negative outcome in the marketplace.
Well, you've pointed out many times before, Dave, we have enjoyed about 32 years of decreasing rates. And when you build a paradigm around that, when you say, well, things are always going to be this way, when rates get pretty close to zero, that's not necessarily the case. Now, what you're telling me is if interest rates even rise 1%, okay, according to the Campbell letter, the cost of buying a home goes up about 10% on the mortgage, and the value of the home for the person selling the home may actually drop by 20%. Now, we're only talking 1% here.
May drop by 10% for every 1 percentage point increase. So if we go and normalize by 2%, then you're dealing with a closer to 20% decline in real estate.
Okay, but there's still, it's very, very substantial. Now, you know, Bill Gross has pointed out that what we've had in the past may not be what we have in the future.
Well, that's right. It's the tailwind that we've gotten. Corporate profits have been improved because of a decline in interest rates. And that declining interest rate trend has also, when you're looking at real estate, improved your cap rates or decreased your cap rates considerably. And this, in his opinion, and in ours, is reversing. So if declining rates were a tailwind for growth, what are increasing rates then? They would have to be a headwind, and this is a state of affairs that we expect for this foreseeable future.
Well, then let's look at running a corporation. Okay, we know that cash levels, because cash has been very, very readily available during this period of time of bailout, quantitative easing, low interest rates. We know corporate cash is at a record level, but there's another record that's being set at the same time, and I think there's something to read into that, and that is a record level of debt. Now, what is that telling us about the corporation here in America?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. Number one, there's cash that could be utilized for operations, and it's been held overseas by most of your multinationals because they don't have to pay 35% tax on it as long as they leave it with their foreign subsidiaries. So basically, corporate America is raking in profits and not having to pay taxes on it because of what they call a tax or jurisdictional arbitrage. And they're masters at this, where essentially, you know, trillions of dollars in revenues goes untaxed until they repatriate it. So there's those cash profits sitting out there, and they don't want to bring them home because they don't want to pay taxes on them. They can always expand their business overseas. So it serves a long-term purpose in terms of development of their business. But on the other hand, the balance sheet, as you mentioned, in the first quarter of this year, corporate balance sheet has been debauched to the tune of $223 billion. That's $223 billion in debt that was added to corporate balance sheets just in the first quarter of this year. And that's okay as long as business picks up and we have growth as the thematic. But even if you have a marginal drop in business, now your interest payments are that much harder to make. Not to mention, if the bond king Bill Gross is right and we actually see a reversal in trend in interest rates, now all of a sudden the burden of higher rates on corporations, now you're talking about a real headwind in terms of earnings growth.
So what they're really hoping for is recovery, because if we don't have recovery, those increased debts are going to be a huge lead weight around their neck.
Well, that's exactly right. Well, and then you've got sort of, you might even call it the Snowden effect. People aware of the reach of the U.S. government and not being comfortable with it, whether it's at Treasury or with our State Department or with our military interventions. And, you know, we talked about Russia and Ukraine more last week, but you've got Russian companies that are now shifting out of their cash positions that have comfortably been held in U.S. dollars, and they're moving out of dollars and moving towards what gives them sort of a proxy for the U.S. dollar, that is the Hong Kong dollar, because the Hong Kong dollar is tied. It is tied to the U.S. dollar in terms of its valuation. But who controls the Hong Kong dollar? Is it the U.S. Treasury? No, it's not. And it gives Russian companies and any other company, frankly, for that matter, who is concerned about treasury interference or freezing of assets or further sanctions, it gives them latitude to continue to operate and do so without the incursion or the complication of the U.S. government. I think one of the interesting elements there is that this is an element of erosion in terms of dollar priority. The dollar has been the assumed holding in a cash position for corporate America, for international companies, for governments. And there is this growing concern that our adventurism out there, our extraterritorial requirements, I mean, you see it right now. The French are basically saying, you just handed down a $9 billion bill to one of our banks. And our question is, do you have jurisdiction here?
Well, it's not just the French. I mean, in Rome, Berlin, London, these guys are saying, yeah, we're with the French on this one. Sorry, that's too much money.
Well, right, not only too much, but what exactly is your role in our part of the world? Last time we looked, we have our own people doing what you do, and we kind of recognize our national boundaries. So it's in about 10 different areas where you see sort of this assumption of U.S. presence and that it is justified. And yet the world is looking and saying, we don't need your dollars. We're happy to take Hong Kong dollars. We don't need your rules. We make up our own quite well. Thank you very much. And it is this strange disconnect between the way we operate and the disposition in which we operate and the way other people are sort of sitting with their hand on their chin, looking at us quizzically saying, what in the heck are you doing?
Well, they're not just talking. They're signing treaties. They're working around the dollar. I'm thinking right now of the treaty that was signed in May between Russia and Belarus and Kazakhstan, the Eurasian Economic Union. You know, Dave, in our lifetime, we've seen the dollar completely unchallenged. When you and I were young, the dollar was completely unchallenged as a worldwide trade currency. And then we saw the EU come in, and it's held up quite nicely, thank you very much, even with all the debt problems that they have. The euro has become an issue. But now we have the EEU, okay, the Eurasian Economic Union, and probably more to come from there.
It's important to watch natural resources. It's important to watch capital flows. It's important to watch the trade relationships that are developed, because ultimately trade drives the long-term political relationships that you see develop or devolve in the world picture. And the fact that they are moving east, moving towards China, and there is an energy complex which we don't control, namely the Middle East and Russia, it really means that our interests ultimately are pitted against the Middle East and Russia. And this is where, again, you see our foreign policy take shape. I frankly don't know what to think, Kevin, because when it comes to sort of an ethical appraisal of our foreign policy, I know how it matches out or measures out from the standpoint of morality. From the standpoint of sheer self-interest, it's a very different calculus. So we will do what is in our best interest, but it may not be the right thing or the good thing to do in terms of a way that others would feel respected, appreciated, etc., etc., in the rest of the world. Perhaps that sounds pitifully naive, or perhaps even like a Jimmy Carter-esque statement, but there is a conflict between the way we act and the way we talk. And we talk, it is as if we are morally unchallengeable. And yet, if you really knew what drove this country, what drove our international politics, what drove our foreign policy, I think all of us would want to go outside and throw up. My suggestion is this, as we look at these fingers of instability, political and geopolitical rancor, truly an unsolved financial problem, not only in Europe, but here in the United States as well, and an economic growth problem which has yet to be solved, can't be done with the printing of money, has been tried over and over again, and the results have been terrible in each instance, where you're either getting rid of debt via the printing press or destroying culture thereby. You know what? We think this is still a time to batten down the hatches. Batten down the hatches, be very comfortable with a cash position, be very comfortable with a precious metals position, physical gold and silver. Again, the time that lapsed between 1909 and 1914 was very short, and no one in that short period of time could have expected or anticipated the changes which were immediately ahead of them. And you went back to the alliances which existed before these minor skirmishes and conflicts occurred, and it was those alliances which acted like a megaphone. A very small voice became a very loud message, one of conflict and chaos, and that is what we feel is immediately in front of us.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.